We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Professor Richard E. Hult, better known as Bud Hult, talking to us from South Carolina, where he's been a professor of educational psychology there at the University of South Carolina for over 35 years. Welcome, Bud.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's great to be on your program. Very impressed.
Well, thank you for being willing to talk with us for a whole hour this afternoon. We're talking today with Bud Hult about the reinvention of self as an older adult. And Bud, how did you happen to come on this, to select this topic?
Well, I just thought it was a pretty jazzy title. Now, there are three or four things, I think. The first is that, since I was a professor at University of South Carolina for 35 years, I taught courses and seminars in lifespan development and the aging process. And secondly, I wanted to choose a topic, which might be relevant to many of the listeners that you have. And I wanted to have some good news to talk about. I mean, obviously, when you talk about aging, there's good news and there's not so good news. But when you turn on the television and you get the news, quite often it's just bad news from the economy and so on. But the fact is, we're living longer now. For example, in the United States, the number of centenarians grew from 32,194 or so in 1980 to 71,944 by November of 2010. So, we are living longer and we have more opportunity to enjoy life in the later years and do more things. And so I wanted to address that. But particularly, I was really struck by our 50th class reunion. I might just add that Steve and I are our classmates. We both graduated in 1961 from Urbana High School. And so I'm telling on you, Steve. I'm telling about your age. But that puts us in the age range. I mean, I'm 67. I'm sure Steve's much older. No, actually. But we're about 67, 68. And so that we're right on the cusp of either retiring or deciding to not to retire and to put our energies and talents to work. And of course, Steve has hosted the radio show, and
you've kind of both retired and not retired too. Are you still teaching part time?
Yeah, I'm still teaching one course, per semester at USC, and I'm.
Although you're officially professor emeritus.
Yeah, well, I'm a professor emeritus, yeah. And so I'm hired back as an adjunct.
Okay.
When I do that, and so it's the good news is I don't have to go to any faculty meetings anymore.
Now, what's the one course you're teaching now, Bud?
Well, I was teaching a basic course in educational psychology to undergraduates, and it's called Learners in the Diversity of Learning. So it's really more about classroom learning. It's not really a lifespan course.
Before we get into the announced topic of reinvention of self as an older adult, talking about those issues, we've recently here in Champaign-Urbana had a letter republished by our local paper by someone who had recently retired as a professor at University of Illinois in Chicago, who said all kinds of nasty things about, what a cushy life it is as a professor, and how he's really ripping off the taxpayers and teaching very little. And he was able to successfully avoid teaching undergraduates for many of his last years. And yet here you are, still sound like you enjoy teaching undergraduates.
I really do.
You received awards for your teaching of undergraduates. Why? What appeals to you about it?
I guess that, I taught large classes, but I really felt like I, was very much a part of the university life. I tried to make connections with undergraduates where I could, try to make a difference in their lives and so on. But, the thing is that when you teach large classes, and you teach as long as I have, you see them in all shapes and sizes, and they come in, the distributions of interest, of talent, of motivation to achieve, and so on. But I've had some wonderful students, it's a great feeling, I think. And I think teaching really at any level. I have great admiration for teachers, who work with K through 12 students, and put themselves in that position to really make a difference. It's the lives of our undergraduates. I mean, they're still struggling, actually, with the topic that we're going to deal with tonight, which is identity a little bit. I don't think you can talk about the reinvention of self without talking about identity. And undergraduates are struggling with that. They have to make some important decisions with their lives after they graduate. And so part of their coursework involves self-examination, and I encourage that. And wherever possible, I try to, I try to help a little bit with asking them further questions. So it's been very rewarding, to me anyway.
So let's talk a little bit about here. You and I are in our mid-60s, late-60s. We knew each other in high school. We've seen each other at a few high school reunions over the years, and we enjoy talking with one another. That's one reason I ask you to be on this program, because I enjoyed talking to you and arguing with you about various issues, religious and philosophical and literary, when we were kids. So I've looked forward to this hour today on the phone with you on the radio.
Well, good.
But how are you different now than you were then? Have you reinvented yourself?
Well, that's a very good question. I've faced this retirement question with some degree of skepticism and concern, but I have recently got involved with a senior Kiwanis club, which has really opened some new doors. And when I talk about self reinvention, I think it's like, it's the new learning and the new experiences and the new connections that you make, where you see just all kinds of new opportunities to devote your talents and your energies to, and once again, that can lead to all kinds of new learning, to new friendships, to new service work, and so on. To some degree, I have, feel like I have done that. I don't think, I probably should say this right off the bat, that when we say reinvent ourselves, I think that's more of kind of a device that we can't take that in a total literal sense. I mean, we sort of take it in a more metaphorical sense. That's kind of the way I meant it. But I really mean it in the context of midlife and later midlife years. So what I kind of wanted to address this, first of all, by talking just a little bit about the theory of Erik Erikson. And when I was at the University of Illinois, and I did get my PhD and did my dissertation on Erik Erikson while I was at Illinois, and I found Erikson to be useful to me. I mean, I'm certainly not trying to dispel anyone on the idea that Erik Erikson has the answers. No theorist has a corner in the truth market by any means. And he simply will say, you know, I just have a way of looking at things, which I hope is helpful. And it was helpful to me. If anybody's interested in reading Erikson, I would suggest, first of all, taking a look at his classic work, Childhood and Society, which came out in 1950, and it was translated into 63 languages and was required reading for child psychiatry in most programs. And that was the place where you first saw, you know, the 8-stage theory of the life cycle. I'm not going to be going through, you know, I could talk about Erikson all night, but I'm not going to do that. But other books that might be of interest to the listeners, Insight and Responsibility, Identity, Youth, and Crisis, and when he was older, in 1986, he came out with the book Vital Involvement in Old Age that he wrote with his wife, Joan, and also Helen Kibnick. The pivotal concept in Erikson's theory is what I want to talk about just a little bit, and that's the concept of identity. And identity basically means the sense of self, you know, who we are. You know, the old adage about know thyself, which I believe probably Steve, you know, better than I do because you're more literary. But I think Socrates was maybe the first to say this, but it was certainly picked up by Shakespeare and so on. But it is, you know, such an important thing because we need to have self-knowledge to make important decisions about life. I say it's his pivotal concept in his theory because I think all of his childhood stages that he talks about, his 8-stage theory, build towards this identity versus role confusion issue, which he speaks about is so important for adolescence. And then all of the adult stages that he speaks about, the three adult stages that he speaks about, become the kind of testing grounds for how we forge our sense of who we are. Our sense.
What are Erikson's three adult stages?
Well, his first is what is called intimacy versus isolation. This is the early adult period. The second, which I think is very germane for tonight, which corresponds to the midlife period, and roughly, you know, ages 35 to 65, the time of retirement. And he speaks about the issue here of generativity versus stagnation. Okay, now, when I'm talking about versus, generativity versus stagnation, I'm really talking about the personality strength, okay, versus the personality weakness. For Erikson, as a developmental theorist, you know, he viewed the life cycle, you know, this whole journey of life, as a sequence, let's say, of sensitive periods, where developmentally speaking, opportunities present themselves for a personality strength to be developed over a personality weakness. You know, like for example, in the very first stage, the issue of trust versus mistrust, which applies to the first year and a half of life or so. We know that's such an important foundational point because when babies come into the world, they're very, very dependent. And when you and we all need to be able to trust people to have meaningful relationships. And, you know, when they come into the world, if they experience the world as a very good, welcoming place, a positive place, you know, if they experience responsivity from their environment in a healthy way, they develop confidence. They develop a feeling like, I can count on my environment. The world's a good place to be, you know. And so this carries forward with the development of a sense of trust, And we know now that that is a very fundamental thing that's related to human attachment, secure human attachment, which is a milestone, you know, in the early developmental years. But I don't want to go through all of these childhood stages because we don't have time for that. But to point out that he sees these as like sensitive periods. And the optimal outcome for each one of these sensitive periods is not something where you have, let's say, an all-trusting baby, because the world is not trustworthy completely. you want to have, like, he speaks about, you know, basic trust over mistrust. All right, so on balance, the baby comes out of this period and it has a good sense that things can be counted on and, you know, that, you know, people are going to be there and so on. It basically means the idea that the world is understandable, it's intelligible, it's predictable, you know. And but, you know, there are things that you don't want to trust, you know. And you find that out by, you know, putting your hand on a hot stove and things like that. So when we get into the more complicated periods, he still means basically personality strengths versus personality weaknesses. You know, if we go back to this pivotal concept of identity versus role confusion, basically in the adolescent years and up through the early adulthood years, you know, this is a time when young people need to do a lot of, like, self-examination and self-search, and basically identity involves that. When we speak about identity crisis, basically the word crisis means search. It means to really look for ways to be. And the problem with young people is they, of course, they do this kind of searching, but they do it by experimenting. And they're, you know, literally like trying on different hats to see how they fit and how they might fit. But this might take them in any direction where they get mixed up with peers, which may become may lead them to destructive activity, and the destructive activity may be quite serious.
I want to get back to those kind of choices, particularly for older adults. But let me reintroduce our guest for listeners who may have joined us after the top of the hour. We're talking today with Richard E. Hult, professor of educational psychology at the University of South Carolina. His PhD came from University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And we're talking about the reinvention of self in older adults today on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host, and let me encourage listeners to join this conversation. Let me give some phone numbers. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area where WILL studio is, punch into your phone 333-9455, and our engineer, Kyle Crowe, will put you in line to talk with our guest today, Bud Hult. That's spelled H-U-L-T. If you're listening long distance from Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, in Indiana, anywhere from Indianapolis all the way to Chicago, punch in a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And that's true also if you're listening on the Internet at will.illinois.edu/AM. That 800 number is good, of course, anywhere in the continental U.S., 1-800-222-WILL or 9455. Getting back with our guest today, Bud Hult. Bud mentioned that he and I were classmates here at Urbana High School, and we recently saw each other at our 50th reunion. And so it was fun seeing him and other classmates who are at this stage in our lives. Bud, you were telling the three adult stages in Erickson's.
Yeah, right.
What is the third?
The third is the final stage. And this is the late stage of adulthood, where Erickson saw that the strength, the ego strength, the personality strength that he would talk about, would be integrity. And the weakness that he would speak about here is despair. And the reason that he chooses these words, I mean, I think it's interesting to look at the choice of words that he makes here. You know, when you reach the end of your, toward the end of your life, and you begin to get a feeling that, you know, there's not much time left, and, you know, many of the people that you did know are gone. I mean, to age, this is the brutal fact. I mean, and we all know it. But aging means loss, right? And it means losing friends. It means losing spouses, the career, and in the end, it may mean losing independence and so on. And so finally, you do get a sense about the end. But from the Erickson perspective, I mean, you know, the feeling is to be able to look back on what you have left behind, and have you in fact taken your identity that you have forged, your sense of self, and shared it and spread it and made a difference? Okay, the things that we were talking about earlier, and if you have that sort of satisfaction that you've done that, then you have what Erickson calls this sense of integrity. Now, if you haven't done this, he speaks about the negative sense here, but, well, there's not a whole lot of time. You cannot go back now and redo things. You cannot go back now and have children. You can't, you know, you can't do a lot of the things you might have been able to do. And so there's this real sense of loss that you really haven't left much behind or haven't made much difference. And he speaks of the word despair. And so this is the final chapter in the life cycle. You know, so he, but I would want to turn to the middle adulthood period that he speaks about, the generativity versus stagnation. In other words, when we are, when we finally, you know, set sail with who we are in the adulthood years, we make choices about careers. We get married. We decide that you know, we're going to be work in the church, or we're going to, you know, become a military person, and we're going to go to Afghanistan if we, you know, make that kind of commitment. We do these things, but the question is, you know, do we, with our identities, ourselves, do we generate? Okay, now, what he means here by directly is the biological generativity of having children and then taking care of those children. But he doesn't mean it just in that sort of literal sense. He means generativity in a wider sense. It again, you had asked me earlier about why what I did as a teacher, you know, and why I like to work with undergraduates. Well, I like to work with undergraduates because I feel like I could perhaps, you know, make a difference in some of their lives. I could develop some kind of close relationships with some of them, you know, and mentor and, you know, counsel and those kinds of things. And those are really, you know, if you want to really talk about the rewards of that particular field, it's the relationships and the feedback that you get along those kinds of lines. Generativity certainly means creativity. Okay, so, and I noticed that some of our classmates were extremely successful, you know, in their careers, and they did wonderful things, you know, and they're doing more things now. And you know, so some people, you know, have the talents and the ability to work in the field of medicine, and do research and have the good fortune to, let's say, be on a research team that makes great breakthroughs and discoveries. This is all part of what Erickson means by generativity. You know, it's putting the sense the self to work and extending the self and sharing the self, and making the self count for something. And if we don't do that, then we feel this sort of like sense of stagnation, and so on. But you know, one of the things I wanted to get to, as we move to this point about the reinvention of self, was that a few years ago, back in the 1970s or so, there was a popular term called the midlife crisis that came out that I think most of the listeners have heard of. And Daniel Levinson, among others, you know, and Daniel Levinson came out with a book on which he reported a study on the seasons of a man's life. And he reported that that of his male subjects, that a very large percentage of them experienced some kind of a real midlife crisis. Now, again, the word crisis in this context does mean, you know, self-examination. It means like, you know, but it's a different kind of a crisis experience than the adolescent. I mean, when the adolescent looks in the mirror, and we know many adolescents spend a lot of mirror time, and they see themselves, you know, and when a midlifer looks at himself in the mirror, you know, he sees, you know, perhaps an aging process, and he begins to think of time left to live, and have I achieved the goals I've wanted? Have I done the things that I've wanted? Have I done them well enough? Am I happy? Have I achieved my goals and these kinds of things? So it's kind of like the self-examination, but it's also the sort of and the midlife crisis kind of came to be a kind of like almost a catchphrase, and it kind of had a pejorative sound to it. In other words, if you know, the self-examination would lead to self-doubt, which could lead to depression, and that could lead to really bad decisions about what one might do in terms of ripping up the fabric of one's life. Having affairs, you know, getting divorced, and that sort of thing. Now, the interesting thing is that, you know, since the 1970s, midlife crises, you know, people have studied this and have done some good research, and it is found that you know, a much lower percentage of individuals, both men and women, in the midlife years report any kind of, like, real midlife crisis. I mean, there is self-examination, and, you know, this kind of thing. But most of the time, it's usually a self-examination which results in going back and recommitting oneself to one's place in life. I mean, one's earlier commitment, and that is in terms of marriage, in terms of profession, and in terms of one's place of residence, and that kind of thing. But you know, what I would like to turn to is a new book, a relatively new book, a book that kind of struck me. It is an academic book, but the book is entitled "The Third Chapter," and the subtitle is "Passion, Risk, and Adventure in the 25 Years After 50." And it's written by Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. And she is a PhD and a distinguished Harvard professor of education and sociology. The book came out in 2009.
Third chapter of life is that time from 50 to 75.
Yes, okay. Correct. It's almost like you could say the third quarter.
Sure.
The third quarter. But she calls it the third chapter. I don't think that's really a new term. I actually think that came out in French literature at one time, but I'm not sure of that, so the book is, I think, a very good read. I would recommend it certainly for anybody who's in a book club out there and is looking for something to look at and critically examine.
And again, the author is Sarah Lawrence
Lightfoot. And now Lawrence Lightfoot is hyphen. You know, it's a hyphen.
And Lightfoot is spelled
L-I-G-H-T-F-O-O-T.
Okay.
And if you go online, you know, the book is easily obtained through you know, Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble. I mean, also has it online. So it's you know, one can get it. Even if you just type in the third chapter, I think they'll get it. They'll get you, pull you up on it. But just briefly talking about the book, you know, she interviews 40 adults who are spread across the USA, and each of and they're all in this period of age, 50 to 75. They all, you know, each has shares a personal adventure, as she puts it, involving crossing boundaries. You know, and Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is somewhat rather dramatic, but she compares these stories that are reported by the individuals as like anthropological expeditions, and individuals challenging themselves.
Oops, we seem to have a technical problem here. I think maybe I can still be heard, although we've lost our contact with our guest. Let me take a few minutes just to let listeners know what's coming up on Keeping the Faith as we try to solve our technical problem with our guest today, Richard E. Hult, H-U-L-T, Bud Hult, from the University of South Carolina, professor of educational psychology. Next week here on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with a local professor, Walt McMahon. Walter McMahon has a recent book out called Higher Learning, Greater Good, The Private and Social Benefits of Higher Education. And as Walt and I were talking about this program coming up next week, he said what he really wants to deal with is what has your education done for you and your community? So that's what we'll be talking with Professor Walt McMahon next week, August 28, here on Keeping the Faith. Later, September 4th, I'll be traveling, but Don Nolan, a frequent guest host, will be here, and he'll be talking with Reverend Elaine Olson about faith and science with some people here at the University of Illinois from various faith backgrounds, faith traditions, who are scientists. And we'll have one or two of those with Reverend Lane Olson September 4th. September 11 is a very special day, of course, 10 years after the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York City and Washington, D.C. And we'll be replaying a program that was broadcast originally in 2009 with a group of folks from families of victims of that tragic attack. They formed a group called Peaceful Tomorrows, and these family members of people who died in September 11 have tried to influence public policy in terms of U.S. response to that in ways that are peaceful. So that will be replayed on September 11th, the 10th anniversary. Later in October, October 2nd, the author Tess Hillmo will be our guest on Keeping the Faith. She's the author of a new book called With a Name Like Love, a fascinating book for young adults and also older people, and look forward to talking with that author. I understand we've solved the technical problem with our guest, Bud Hult. And Bud, can you hear me all right now?
Yes, I certainly can.
Ah, good. And we lost to hearing you, and it was fine because we were about halfway through our program, and I needed to make announcements about who'd be coming up and to say again that this is Keeping the Faith, and you're listening to WILL AM 580, which can be heard also simultaneously on our FM 90.9 HD3 channel. And also at will.illinois.edu/AM. And if you missed part of this program, not the silent parts, but the talking parts, you can, of course, hear it as it's put on our archives at that same website in a week or so. And again, to get that archive, just type in your computer, will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith. And you can leave the G off of keeping. We're informal in our title here. Well, getting back to Bud Hult, you were telling us about this new book, and called The Third Chapter, Passion, Risk, and Adventure in the 25 Years After 50 by Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot from Harvard.
That is correct, yes. And as I was saying, you know, the book is based upon her 40 subjects that she interviewed and studied in depth, rather, and they all shared you know, sort of the, as she puts it, sort of this personal adventure involving crossing boundaries. And she compared this to kind of like an anthropological expeditions where they were, these individuals were challenging themselves to leave the comfortable niche of their mid-careers and take risks. I mean, and so I think that we could say that the subjects, you know, that she actually interviewed shared several things. I mean, they one, had a deep curiosity to know something new, to do something new, which I think this is wonderful, you know, in terms of a quality that that older adults can have. And secondly, they had an ability to relinquish the fear of the unknown, the fear of failure, something that we all, you know, well, this is a challenge for all of us, I guess, when we try something new. And being able to actually identify the fear and take a leap of faith, literally. A willingness to be vulnerable. And finally, a readiness to embrace contradictions, integrate the new with the familiar. Now, I just want to speak about one person here within this the context of this book, one of the subjects. At her 60th birthday, is a neurobiologist, Anna Nielsen, one of the women interviewed. She remarked that she felt with sudden urgency, the finiteness of life, and I quote here, I had this big newborn sense that I must do things that I had left undone for too long. Instead of remaining in the research lab, then she decided to bridge the gap between research and public policy, and she went on to work on HIV and AIDS in East Africa, which is quite a change. Others, one more example, Charles Watkins, who's a corporate lawyer, embarked on working on public gardens in Boston Chinese community, where he discovered the, quote, the gladness of opening his heart to the world's great hunger. And so, you know, the people that she interviewed were perhaps kind of special people, but they made big changes, and they did a kind of a self-reinvention, and I would recommend the book. It's not a book that claims to, you know, be representative as a cross-sample of individuals, you know, from all walks of life by any means.
But the two examples you gave make it sound like it makes me wonder, did she only select people who sort of made positive changes that would help the wider world, or did she find some people who became criminals?
Well, no, she definitely has a mix of people in there who, you know, who underwent change, and they weren't all, you know, just, you know, wonderfully altruistic in terms of what they did and how they did change. But I think that they were, they were in a position in terms of their socioeconomic status where they could take, you know, these risks for change. I think there are a number of a lot of people, you know, within this age group, where it's very difficult for people to make changes, to take big risks.
People who are living from paycheck to paycheck may not have that luxury.
Exactly. And, you know, they know that they've got a family that really is counting on them, and they can't do this. And so, you know, and we're living in such times. Well, this is one of the criticisms, I mean, in terms of reviews of her book. But I still think the book is very much worth reading. And it's written in a very, you know, scholarly and elegant style. I would certainly recommend it. But what I'd like to do now is just to turn to the question of self-reinvention for older adults, okay, who are beyond the third chapter. I mean, and so now we're talking about you know, beyond 75 years. You know, what can we do as older adults? What does the reinvention of self mean for that? And here I turn back to a theme that whenever I taught lifespan development, I mean, you know, all periods are characterized by continuity and change. And when you get into a developmental period with a lot of change, that's a very difficult period, such as that which is occurs in early adolescence, the age period from 10 to 15. Young people at that age often have real difficulties. In fact, I get on my soapbox and I say, if you're looking to make a change and you can work with young people, boy, we don't just need teachers out there. We need good teachers, and we need good teachers at the middle school level, and we need good counselors, you know, at the middle school level, because we lose a lot of human potential, you know, during this time. Of early adolescence.
And there are ways people can be involved as mentors and tutors as well.
Yes, tutors.
Part-time folks.
And so on. So, you know, when you look for volunteer work, this is certainly one place that you might check on. But let's move to this older period. I mean, coping with change can be difficult. The particular challenge for older adults is the sheer number of changes and transitions, I think. And this includes something I said earlier, the loss of family, friends, career, and perhaps ultimately your health and your independence. So it's natural to feel these losses. But if that sense of loss is balanced with certain positive kinds of ingredients, I think you can really enjoy life longer and enjoy the quality of life much better. And I do want to say that healthy aging means continually reinventing yourself. And by this, I mean finding new things to enjoy, you know, and they could be big and small. Learning to adapt to change, staying physically and socially active, feeling connected to your community and loved ones. But unfortunately, for many, aging brings anxiety and fear, and this can mean, such questions as, how will I take care of myself? You know, what if I lose my spouse? What's going to happen to my mind? However many of these fears stem from myths about aging that are exaggerated or simply untrue. I mean, we still feel these. The truth is that we can be stronger and more resilient than we might think as we age. This is what research is telling us.
Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who'd like to ask our guest, Bud Hult,
sure,
a question. 333-9455 if it's you're in the 217 area code, if it's a local call to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. If it's long distance, do give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. And that includes listeners online at will.illinois.edu/am. Bud, you were saying there's some things that people can do positively to find new things to enjoy.
Right. And I want to kind of go through, and this is sort of a list of things, but I mean, as you age, there will be periods of joy and stress. It's really important to build resilience and find healthy ways to cope with challenges. So I want to just kind of like go through some of the things that I've read about. I've recently read a book, or I know about a book, and another book that I want to recommend. I know I keep bringing books up here, but this is a book by Mary Lore, L-O-R-E, and it's called Managing Thought. You know, how do your thoughts rule your world? And she has been a very successful consultant, you know, to CEOs into business and so on. And she's done quite well. But among the things that she suggests that I think really do apply to spirituality, to helping us build a more healthy sense of mindfulness, is each day we have to focus on the things that we should be grateful for, or we are grateful for. The fact is, the longer you live, the more you lose. But as you lose people and you lose things, life becomes even more precious in a way. I mean, you know, there are different ways to look at it. You can think of, well, you know, life has less meaning, but you can also see it from the standpoint of, like, life becomes more precious because there's less of it. And you want to preserve, and you experience it in the best way you can. When you stop taking things for granted, you appreciate and enjoy, you know, what you have even more. And so I mean, she's got a chapter in there called Managing Spirit. And for developing and being in touch, you know, with the spiritual self, the author suggests taking time each day to be thankful. And I think that's really important. I know this is very close to being prayerful, but, you know, for some who may not, let's say, you know, do not subscribe to an organized religion, I think this is a spiritual element which is probably is universal. You know, I think it is. Another point about aging is, and this goes along with the Serenity Prayer that I think most people have heard. But you got to accept the things that you can't change, and try to understand what you do have control of, and exercise the best kind of control that you can. You try to look for the positive, for the silver lining, you know, and you may undergo a great deal of difficulties. I mean, I know that a few years ago, I mean, I'm a prostate cancer survivor, so at one time, you know, I had to deal with that, and I still have to deal with it. But I feel very lucky that I got the surgeon that I did. And, you know, you can adopt kinds of things, I think, that are healthy in terms of, like, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And so as we look at these kinds of challenges, we can look at them in a positive way.
Where does that inner strength come from to be able to do that?
I'm sorry?
Where does that inner strength come from to be able to do that, to look at the positive at a time like when you're facing cancer?
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes you're lucky because you have, the support group around you to help you do that. You know, my wife, Kella, it really helped me with that. But I decided that I was going to just read as much as I could about it, and I did it. But I was very fortunate in getting the surgeon that I got at Johns Hopkins. And so every time I think about, but I'm not, you know, it's not like it's a done deal. I thought it was, but it isn't. I mean, I still have to deal with it. I got an appointment this coming, you know, this Friday. But I think without my original surgery, it would have really been tough.
You mentioned the support from your wife. Did your family of origin have a basic positive? Did your family of origin have a basic sort of positive attitude towards life? Did you get any of that from, I know your father was a professor here at the University of Illinois, too.
Yeah, I think I was very lucky. I think I was very lucky about my family. I feel quite grateful that I had the parents I had. And, you know, yeah, there have been bumps in life and that sort of thing. But It doesn't take much to look around and see people who are much, much less fortunate. I feel very grateful, you know, that I had that I grew up in, time that I grew up in, that I had the family I had, and that I got a chance to go to Urbana High School. Meet people like Steve Shoemaker.
And the University of Illinois.
Yeah, and the University of Illinois. So
when you've talked to students who are you know, so much younger than you are now, can they relate to any of this with their life experiences?
It's increasingly difficult. And because the kind of world, you know, that younger people are growing up in, you know, is so different. I mean, everybody is on Facebook and, you know, has cell phones and, you know, all of these kinds of things are positive things, I guess, potentially, but they're so different. It's tough. Anyway, I want to just mention just a few more things when we're talking about healthy aging, if I might.
Because oh, sure.
I think that connecting regularly with family and friends, you know, and if you don't have the family and friends, then you make an effort to make new friends. And by that, in that way, you are doing this sort of self-reinvention. You know, because you find, as you meet new people, as you make new friends, you really find that new doors do open, and you find new opportunities to grow, new things to learn. I also think spending time with at least one person every day. I mean, I know that sounds maybe a little remote for some people, but I think that's important.
There are a lot of folks who are completely isolated.
Yeah, because I've seen it, I do volunteer work, and that's another thing I wanted to say. I mean, as you grow older, try to find ways in which you can volunteer and give back to the community. It's an amazing thing. About the rewards that you feel from that. I have recently done some things, and I'll just speak about these things in the last couple of minutes here, but I was I volunteered to be a guardian for the Honor Flight Program. And the Honor Flight Program flies World War II veterans to Washington for VIP treatments up there, you know. And so there, these guys, I belong to the Senior Kiwanis Club, and we've got about 15 World War II veterans. And, of course, they're passing on at a fairly rapid rate right now. But I just felt a great sense of satisfaction in doing that. I mean, it cost me, you know, my plane ticket and so on, because I feel so blessed that, you know, that we actually, I was born in 1943, and we grew up and we were shepherded in our kind of our growing period by what Tom Brokaw would call the greatest generation. You know, those men and women who went through the 30s and the Depression and then right into the World War II and so on. And I feel that we were very blessed, you know, by that. You know, just by when the cohort we were a part of. The other thing that, you know, on a simple level, every Thursday I go over to Harvest Hope, which is a food bank, and I work over there. And I do very simple things like I put labels on cans. But you know, I do that with people that I've met and make new friends and so on. But it's a wonderful feeling, though, of trying to make some kind of difference, even in a simple way. So I think it does buoy the spirit to do that. So there are a lot of different things to do. And the final thing I just wanted to mention was this, as I see time is growing short here, I think that...
We have about 2 minutes, Bud. Yeah.
I think that older adults should very much try to be mentally engaged. Okay, so what we do know from a physiological standpoint is that the brain's ability to adapt to changing circumstances, and the ability to learn, for example, and the formation of new neural networks, you know, this continues throughout the lifespan. I mean, this is a big myth that, you know, that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And you certainly can. And with respect to cognitive development, we do lose certain abilities, but we gain in other abilities. So that, you know, Raymond Cattell, who's a psychologist that I studied and I taught, made the distinction between fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence. Now, fluid intelligence is biologically based, and that we tend to lose that you know, speed of perception and so on. But we gain in crystallized intelligence. If we continue to read and engage, we'll grow in vocabulary. And what we like to think is that we kind of grow in wisdom. This is actually, Erickson uses this word, wisdom, as a kind of like a positive outcome, you know, and sort of our final years in the adult years. But we know there are all kinds of wonderful examples of older adults. You know, you take the most celebrated educational philosopher in America, in American history, John Dewey. He was writing well into his 90s. And Immanuel Kant is a philosopher I'm sure that you and I talked about at one point. But I think his greatest work was Critique of Pure Reason, and he wrote that, I believe, in his 80s. So what does apply, though, is the use-it-or-lose-it point. We definitely need to use what we have as we grow older. And for the possibility of reinvention and the possibility of maintaining, healthy adult years.
Bud, we're going to have to leave it. We're going to have to leave it there on that positive note. I want to thank our guest today, Richard E. Hult, Bud Hult, H-U-L-T. He was born here in Urbana, Illinois, as he mentioned, in 1943. Went to Urbana High School and the University of Illinois here with his Ph.D. in educational psychology. Back in 1975, he's had a 35-year career leading to being full professor at the University of South Carolina in the field of educational psychology. He's won a number of awards, including the George Lackey Award for Inspirational Teaching, the highest teaching award in the College of Education, and the Leonard Maiden Spirit of Service Award, the highest award for service activity in the community, state, and nationally. We've been very fortunate to have Bud Hult talk with us today about reinventing oneself as an older adult. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And as I mentioned, I'll be here next week again, and our guest will be Walt McMahon from the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, talking about his recent book, Higher Learning, Greater Good, The Private and Social Benefits of Higher Education. And the following week, Elaine Olson will be here talking about faith and science with Don Nolan, who will be the guest host. Again, thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge and American Concierge magazines. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and a business and shopping guide. Concierge magazines are distributed throughout Central Illinois and always present the Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington-Normal areas at their best.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580.